This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
Well, here we are, the end of the week of the sentencing of Brian Koberger, and we have more questions because more information has come out. And there, of course, was the sentencing itself, which was very interesting, very emotional. I mean, that whole thing ran the gamut of emotions. Here to discuss the sentencing and here also to discuss some of the new pieces that we've learned since things have been unsealed. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and also author of this book, Unbreakable Alliances. Go get it wherever books are sold. I have a library on the front of my desk now of your books, of Siobhan's books, and I just, yeah.
I know. You're so kind. We mentioned so many books on our show, too. Oh. Because it's not just what we take in the world around us, but in order to gain, you know, knowledge, yeah, background, and context, we have to keep consuming other information. And just like we consumed Howard Bloom's book voraciously when The Night Comes Falling about the case. And then also I'm just finishing up James Patterson's book. Which is a different take. You know, I know it's not where we started the show, but it is a different take. It's more of a story because James Patterson's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. You know, he's did the editing, I think, for the writer. But it's a different way to approach an understanding of the case. And it's more about the individuals involved that in all their nooks and crannies and their life arcs, all of them individually. So it was a good read. I think it supplements Howard's book really nicely.
It does. I mean, like, there's like 100-some chapters in that thing. But spoiler alert, they're not super long chapters. Like, they're short chapters. But there's 100-some chapters. So, I'm about like chapter 70 or so right now on that one as I'm working my way
through. It's funny. It's this unwritten competition I'm trying to
beat. It is. I know. I got it. I'm like, I'm reading this book right now. Like, I'm starting it too.
Yep. As he's on the plane flying back. I'm like, no, I'm going
to
beat you.
I was listening to it in the airport. I was talking to my family and had one ear in with the book.
Yeah, I remember. You said you're on chapter 50. It's like, I got it moving.
Yep. There you go. So let's talk about the actual sentencing the other day. We were on together for a bit, and then eventually it did wrap up with everybody giving their parts. And the star of the day, I think, not that anybody should be a star of this, but the one who I think made the most impact and the most not only impact to everyone out there watching, but to Koberger most importantly, and to herself being able to get this out off of her chest, for lack of a better term, Olivia Gonzalez there. And you see where it came from once the whole family talked. It's like, oh, I get where they learned this. It was powerful. What was your thoughts on that and just how she eviscerated him? And how do you think it read to Koberger?
Like you, Tony, I'm watching this live with you, and I've watched victim witness statements before, and it started out exactly like I thought it was going to, gut-wrenching with the roommates, with the people that love those beautiful children in their lives. It started with Koberger sitting there stone-faced, you know, just unimpacted by anything, right? And then the Gonzalez's got up there. And when the dad turned the podium towards him directly, and then, like you said, when Olivia got up there and completely eviscerated him, and that's the only word that can come to mind, because I think what they did as a family, and they've been on a tear since the beginning of this, and they've been very open and vocal about it, and Olivia as well. Patterson's book talks about her quite well, about what she was doing on the Facebook groups and pages and stuff. They did such a deep dive on not to tell the story of what they lost, but to make his life miserable as possible. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when you're listening to not just Olivia, but her dad, the mom, and just all these people involved, you can see, and I've never seen this before, that they're going to spend the rest of their lives both living and making his a living hell as much as they can. Mm-hmm. It was profound is what it was. I've never been inspired by victim witness statements before. I was inspired listening because they knew how to hit him. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think they must have had consultants that they talked to about how to make an impact with a psychopath, because really that's what they did. You know, they didn't say, woe is me. They didn't say, I mean, she just went at him as a human being.
I have no idea. If she wrote that herself, I mean, it was wonderfully written, but I'm not trying to downplay her performance by any means. It was amazing. But I do wonder if ChatGPT was involved. just a hair. I mean, and I would use it because it helps you craft what you're wanting to say in the most impactful way possible. And I could see like that would have been very helpful in that sort of case to really just, I mean, it was precision strikes directly. It was a good way to put it. Koberger's psyche.
And now the second part of what you said, Tony, how it landed with him.
Yeah.
Hard to tell. You know, he is predictably unresponsive, unemotional and everything. But if we're going to project onto him what we are theorizing him in high levels of psychopathy, again, not licensed clinicians, no testing done, whatnot, but the words that she used to diminish his academic prowess, to attack him as a man, to attack him in all these different areas, because the only thing that motivates someone that has high levels of psychopathy, as we've said numerous times, is a sense of grandiosity and superiority. Mm-hmm. And that's what she attacked very, very, like you said, precision strikes on absolutely everything. It wasn't the woe is me. I mean, you can almost see him. Boy, you can't see it because he didn't give anything. But when all the other victim statements were so emotionally delivered, and gosh, they were so powerful, and you could almost think that someone like him was probably just eating that up because he's just that horrible. But then when she came in there and flipped that script, I don't want to say she victimized him because he's not a victim, but she made him feel like a victim.
She put him in his place. Yeah.
100%. I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
Quite done so well. So if she did use ChatGPT, good. I don't care what.
Good. I don't care what how she did it, but whatever she did, damn. I mean, 100%. That was amazing. What she did. Many family members, people in the courtroom noted, even Olivia noted, she said to Brian Enten of News Nation that he was clenching his jaw and he might have forgotten to blink. Others noticed the same thing, specifically when Olivia was addressing him. And I noticed that too. With the others, you could tell, like, there was almost like a, I don't know, I want to say jovial, but he was just kind of, I felt like he was eating it up from the very beginning. And then when she came on, you could tell. I mean, and the fact that he did tighten up, his jaws clenched, and his eyes are not blinking.
Yep.
What do you think was going through his mind? I mean, is any of that resonating with him? Obviously, his prism is so different than everyone else's. So you get, it's like, how is he taking this? Is he just getting hurt and then just lashing out in his brain at her and just calling? I mean, or is it just, yeah, I mean, is it confirmation over and over of what a, you know, pathetic human being he actually is? And it's just, you know, being pounded in again, as he had most of his life.
The thing that, again, projecting, trying to use that deep empathy with someone as vile as this, kind of reversing it as he was taking it. And you made some great points, and Brian Enten has always been on top of this. You know, if we saw a deviation from that very, very nondescript baseline of his with the jaw clench and everything, it means that he was hearing the words she was saying and it was changing his thought pattern, most likely for the negative, because those are tightening and stressful reactions he's having. Now, the way I was interpreting using that deep active, you know, context of him from that position, we said this before too, before the sentencing, was that the shame of the verdict in this, where he gets life and not death sentence, was that he has hope every day of change. He has hope of being able to pursue a degree. He has hope of being studied by others because people are so interested in him as this psychopath or as this serial killer wannabe or all these things. And what happened was, every word she was using, every statement she was making, she was taking that away from him. She was diminishing that. In other words, the only thing I was thinking that might be going through his mind was all those things he was actually looking forward to, gone.
Yeah.
And so he might have been playing that forward a little bit, like listening to those words saying, hey, as soon as this is over, as soon as I suck in all your remorse and all the impact I caused, I got a great day coming tomorrow because I'm going to go here and I'm going to do all these things and these people are going to want to talk to me. And she completely erased that. Mm-hmm. And she demonstrated, not just for today and Steve, the dad as well, you could tell that they're going to spend the rest of their lives ensuring he never has that moment of glory or fame that he thinks he's going to have. And I think he could sense that. I think he could feel that. And I think he believed it.
Yeah, I think that that's going to come as a little surprise to little Brian. Another big
little
part.
Brian, that's a great word.
Yeah, yeah.
Little Brian.
Little Brian, yeah. Another big part of it, Steve Gonsalves is up there, and we talked about it very briefly during that break, but I want to expand on it more. There was a lot of people who were calling for prison justice in the in the victim impact statement. I've never seen it that many times in a row, everything from sodomizing him to killing him behind bars. And it came up a lot from a lot of people. I'm wondering how much Brian Koberger has contemplated that being his future, or if he thinks he's just going to be back there, you know, writing a book and taking interviews and all of that. I wonder if he's considered, you know, you are going to eventually have to interact with people here. They will put you into Gen Pop at some point in time. And there's a big target on your head. And you have a family out there ready to fill canteens and a world, I would say, that's ready to fill canteens who's followed this case for whoever is the lucky person that takes him out.
That's a great question because it resonated with me as well. Matter of fact, it's because we do so much true crime and because people, you can look at your search, you know, things that you put in Google and everything. I actually precluded myself from putting it into Google this morning. Can someone actually do, you know, from the outside, like can Steve Gonsalves actually put a hit on Brian behind bars and would he be prosecuted for it? I mean, I was really curious about it as well. Yeah, so I mean, I'm curious about that as well, but I was afraid to put it in the Google machine to find out. That being said, though, I would have been 100% on thinking that, that's a likelihood. But at the same time, how often does that happen? How often does that happen? It's like, you know me, I'm always going for data and baselines on frequency, commonality, and I don't know, I just don't have any data points on. I need to do some deeper research without triggering Google to come at me.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious about, he's a scary guy. He's a little scarier than I thought he was going to be because that one jailhouse report we had of the one guy that was going to like hit him or got pissed off at him and then Brian's reaction to him was creepy scary.
Yeah.
So it'll be really, really interesting if anyone wanted to give him a time of day again to kind of see if anyone's willing to engage him just because, I mean, he's a cesspool.
He is a cesspool. Yeah. I don't think he's that intimidating to a lot of people behind bars.
No, I don't think he's intimidating. Yeah, again, it's just the
you just don't know what he's going to do. Like that would be the thing. You just don't know what that mind is going to produce, and then what.
That was also in the jail, not in the prison population, which is very different. Yeah. So I think what he got during the victim statements in the sentencing was not the rosy life he thought he was going to have. It turned dark for him than I think he anticipated.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Yes. I mean, I don't know that this has ever been I've joked about it over the years of like somebody should start a business, Canteen for Kills. I mean, it's totally insane and illegal and you couldn't actually do it. Like you're literally like, it would be a hit machine, but you can't do that. But I mean, if you were to literally be in contact with a prisoner, I mean, all that shit's monitored, obviously. And you were saying, I'll fill your canteen directly in a letter. Yeah, you would be charged with murder, with ordering. Well, but if you don't do it directly, if you're just in the ether like this, and people are like, hey, I wonder what that, I would bet people would fill the canteen of whoever does that. Not like, go do it, but just that person knows damn well they will have canteen for the rest of their lives. They'll be the Snickers king if that happens.
So, and here's what I can envision happening more likely than not. And this is what was really, again, I don't know if it was part of the design or not, or it's just manifesting because of it. the reality, you know, I love playing these things forward from the actions we've witnessed and had. Right now, whoever watched inside that prison, who's in population, watched his sentencing, is thinking to themselves, without anyone filling anyone's canteen, mm-hmm. without anyone reaching out to them, is thinking to myself, I can be a hero.
Yeah.
I don't have to do anything, and I will be a hero.
You don't even need incentive, honestly, I think, on this. I
mean, exactly. See what I mean? Yeah. So the Consalvises actually set Koberger up for a very, very rough time whenever he actually hits general population, no matter what anyone else says from that point of view. So that to me was the most grandest strategy, whether by design or chance, that I've ever seen. Yeah. Because he's doomed.
Yeah, they didn't have to like be pen pals with anybody behind bars. Although I do wonder if they are.
I mean, right. Because think about this too. Yeah. So you know, so you go to other wackadoos, yeah. you know, broken brain, you know, people like Lori de Belvallo behind bars who killed her kids, but mm-hmm. she's got this element of crazy charisma yeah. behind her that she can manipulate people and everything because she can become likable, she can endear herself because she is she's just a nutter, right? Mm-hmm. Koberger's not even likable to anyone by anyone. And so he can't even rely on his personality to get by, to at least make one ally. And so I don't see a good day for him coming ever.
No.
Thank God.
As far as we know, as far as I know, and tell me if you've found out anything different, Koberger's dad was not in the.
That's what I heard too. I didn't get confirmation, yeah. but I heard it was just a mom and a sister there. That's
what I was understanding too. Again, I can't confirm it, but that's what I generally believe from what I've heard. What do you think that says? Dad, I mean, dad's the one who seemed to be the one that was, you know, reaching out. He would go drive with him back home, and he did it more than once. The last time was the last time he did it, but that wasn't a unique thing. He did try to basically be there for his son that he knew was a bit off. He's not there. I mean, for something like this, I don't think it's a, well, shoot, I have to work moment. I'm going to guess there was some meaning behind that.
I don't know if his meaning other than he himself, because I mean, just think about the pain he's in. Just think about the pain that the family's in. And I like that they acknowledge that. I mean, I think, again, this is the 30,000 foot level we don't know behind the scenes, but you know, you have a family, every family's been devastated by this one horrendous individual. Mm-hmm. And you got a dad who tried so hard to save his son and ultimately he failed.
Yeah,
and he's now got to listen to. I mean, can you imagine sitting in that courtroom, listen to all these people say these things about your son? Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a statement. I think it was unbearable for him potentially. And the other thing that struck me that Koberger was actually communicating with his mother so much behind bars. You really start wondering, what are they communicating? Because I thought about that a lot. You know, what do you say to a son that who's admitted to doing these horrendous things? The only thing I could think of was, you know, what, again, you try your best to put yourself in a similar situation, as horrendous that is. And I think the only thing that you really can talk about is what you're going to do, mm-hmm. what your days are going to look like, how to deal with this kind of person, we all do with our own kids, you know, as they're facing the challenges in life, kind of mm-hmm. dismiss the actions they took, because if you were going to choose to keep contact with your son, what are you going to talk about? You're going to talk about survival. That's it.
And I guess it is very much a personal decision for them, but I don't know that I could if I were in their shoes.
I don't know either.
I think I would be. You're done. I'm like, you're dead to me.
Why it's really weird. The mother was in so much contact.
Yeah. That's what makes it weird. I mean, it's like, why? Like, what are you, you're there for your little boy who did these horrible, horrendous things, and he's a monster. He can barely communicate as it is.
He's really no longer who he was as your little boy. I mean, the only stupid analogy I have in my head is, you know, Star Wars. And that, but I'm thinking Star Wars. I'm thinking little Anakin Skywalker all of a sudden turns into Darth Vader and he's dead to everyone. I mean, he's, you know, the person he was gone because he chose this dark path. And I think the same thing here.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard as horrendous to say, but to a family member, he's dead.
I don't know that there's any benefit to the living to be in contact with Brian Koberger, even if it's your kid, your brother, whatever it may be. I don't see how that is a positive thing in anyone's life whatsoever. I would feel like They're dead. They are clearly not human, you know, not on a level that one could communicate with any benefit. I feel like you'd be feeding the monster in any way, shape, or form, giving him any sort of little bit of positivity in their day of allowing, you know, mom to talk to him. Like, I don't know. I mean, I would want to see it too.
I think waiting for him to die. I think she's feeding the monster. I think you hit it right on the head, and that's a shame. Again, it's pure conjecture. We have no idea what they are talking about, but you feel for her, but don't feed that monster, man, because he's not your little boy.
I'm wondering how much those jail calls are similar to the ones of Stefan Stearns, the guy who killed Matty Soto. Those jailhouse calls are out there. We've played them before. And Dad is a more pragmatic one, not necessarily getting into the emotions of it, but I think pretty much knowing his son is a monster, but Mom is the one who seems a bit more in denial about the whole thing. I have no idea what those conversations are like now that he's admitted to all of these things and taken the plea. But, I do wonder, I don't know, there's a line, I think, at some point where it's like, I'll be there for you no matter what, not this. Not this. You slaughter four people and you have zero empathy or remorse about it. I mean,
and not just that. I mean, they're looking at him in the courtroom.
Yeah,
he didn't give a rat's ass.
No.
I mean, where do you as a parent? Where do you even make the connection? I mean, I don't even. The hardest part for me to understand during this whole thing, believe it or not, was. And I'm not doubting it because Howard Bloom's got a great insight to this and other people have a great insight too. I have, because when you watch him in the courtroom, you have such a hard time imagining that what anyone thinks is going to influence his choices. It's hard to imagine he's going to make a choice to make it easier on his parents because he doesn't seem to give a rat's ass.
Yeah.
Psychopaths don't care about others. I'm not doubting it if people are saying it and there's data points for him to support it. I still think he did it for himself. He thought, kind of like what we were saying before, I think he said, all right, I'm looking at the data. It's not looking good for me to get off. So the best thing I can do is, hey, let's create this new future for myself. Mm-hmm. Where I'm going to be this, I'm going to be studied, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to do all these great things, and I still have something to look forward to because I didn't care about the world anyway. And I think in my mind, since he's all about him and the grandiosity, he decided to get the plea deal when offered to him again and probably pressed by defense because she knows she's losing. Mm-hmm. Less so than I did it for Mom. I mean, does he look like the type of guy that you'd say, I did it for Mom?
No.
See, that's what I mean? I mean, the data doesn't support it. I mean, he's me. Make my own future. Be in charge of what I think happens.
The only thing I can contemplate would be, they're talking a lot. He is getting something out of Mom's communication with him. And I'm wondering, you know, Howard contemplated that Mom was in control for a while, saying, don't take the plea, don't take the plea. I'm wondering if Mom eventually said, take the plea. And if you don't take the plea, I'm not going to be able to continue talking to you anymore. And I wonder if he saw that as like, that's his own, that's like the only little lifeline, the only human being on this planet who still has a inch of empathy for him. And even she was, I don't know, this is just my conjecture. I wonder if she's the one that drove it. And it wasn't in a way of, I'm going to take the plea to protect my mom, but Mom maybe said, I'm going to withdraw any contact with you. And that was the carrot on the stick that made him do it. Cause that would be a me move. That would be a, well, that goes away. I mean, right. And maybe she just, you know, she knew, they all knew he did it. And
I can see that.
For the best, for the good of everyone, just take the plea. Just do it. Otherwise, you're going to get killed.
So I'm gonna differ on the language for the good of everyone. Yep. He don't care about everyone. He's for the good of himself.
Yep.
Because I think you hit it right on the head there. So if the mother influenced it is because of the impact it was going to have on him about not having some sort of validation from the only person left on the entire planet until you get the friggin' groupies that are now going to want to talk to him.
Yeah.
Is his mom. So yeah. And that's why she's feeding, like you said, she's feeding the beast.
Yeah. And that's
spark where that beast.
Yeah. You got
That's right. Gonsalvis will take care of the entire thing.
Exactly. The wheels are already in motion.
They set it in motion. They can just sit back and watch a show at this point. You know, that family, I tell you what, anyone that is if your needs, if any of them are unemployed at this point, I mean, who wouldn't hire them? I mean, those are doers. God. That's a family of doers.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding.
Problem solving doers.
I put a question out on our YouTube channel. Will Brian Koberger survive prison? If not, how long before prison justice takes him out? I just posted it like right as we began talking here. I haven't got any responses on it yet, but it'll be interesting to see what the general take is on all of that.
Yes, it will. Boy, it's gonna. I thought, Tony, we're gonna be done and over with this, but the Consalvas is really, they're not gonna let it hang. I mean, you see families that are so traumatically impacted as victims through these horrors, and I don't think I've ever seen anyone go on offense as much as this.
No, this is, you're on a mission. I'm on a mission from God to take you out.
They were not victims in that courtroom at all.
No, they definitely brought it. New information has come out in the case against Brian Koberger. This from the unsealing of many, many documents, the police reports coming out, and there's a lot more to come. It's basically just a matter of how quickly can they get this information into a public forum that's adaptable to be consumed. Some of the pieces that have come out are very interesting, I think it almost challenges a little bit the idea that Koberger just happened to decide on that house that night. There's reports from Kaylee Gonsalves that she thought she was being watched while walking her dog. Other roommates hearing noises, seeing a shadowy figure nearby the house leading up to this. There's other things as well that we can get into. Do you think it was Koberger? Do you think this was part of his stalking that they, I mean, obviously we knew he went by the house all those times. We don't know what else he did, but I'd be very curious if he entered that house prior to this actually taking place and had a bit of an idea of its layout. They had a door that was broken that got off its hinges, literally, like 9 days before all this went down.
I think there's a good possibility of it. As human beings, matter of fact, every time a tragedy like this happens, and I'm doing some news thing other than yours, you know, one of the things that cops always ask the public to do is be diligent. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what I'll do is I'll try to define for people what diligence looks like. And what diligence looks like is, hey, everyone pay attention to what the baseline normal is around you. So that when something deviates from that baseline, you're going to say, hey, that's a little different, and you pay attention. Mm-hmm. Because as human beings, we can get that what I call the spider sense or tremors in the force, or when something looks different. And so what we're seeing with some of the reporting we're seeing is that the girls were seeing some tremors in the force, some deviations from that normal mm-hmm. look like. So something or someone was causing that deviation that gave them a little bit of a creepy off feeling. Mm-hmm. Could have been Koberger. Yes, no doubt. Could have been other creepy people. Yeah, because there's a lot of creepy people in the world, especially if you have a house that's got high traffic in the area. Yeah. So it could be a lot of things, but I would not rule out that it could have been Koberger, especially since, and I'm still holding with this, you know, he went to Idaho to murder. That was mm-hmm. part of what he wanted to do, because he bought the knife before he went out there. I think it was in his mind that he was going to do some sort of crime like this. Mm-hmm. Part of the next phase of that was identifying victims and identifying location. I think he was collecting data points on both simultaneously. I think the venue itself created an opportunity because it was so open, because it had high traffic area, because it represented, if his symbology comes in at all, represented the things he couldn't have, and that is being included with people that liked each other. Mm-hmm. Then you also had the girls.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, well-liked, well out there, and also, you know, up in the room where you could see, not Maddie, it was it Maddie? That you could, that she,
yeah, it was Maddie. Yeah,
he was Maddie, you know, yeah, by her window. So
which is alluded to a lot in that new, the James Patterson book,
right?
That he would sit outside the window. I mean, this is the conjecture of Patterson, that he would sit outside that window and watch her. And I believe it, that makes total sense. It also makes more sense too of, this amping up in behavior where he finally did go into the house, where we don't have anything. There's no evidence that he was on social media following them or anything. One would think at this day and age that, you know, if you got a thing for the girl, and obviously it's more than a thing, this was obsessive stalking, but if you're the obsessive stalker, you'd be on their social media. You'd be looking at the pictures of them. I mean, I guess one could say, you know, maybe he was and it was just erased and he wasn't necessarily following. There may have been that. I mean, there's ways I'm sure one could do that and really never show up in a history. So I would wonder if that existed, but he certainly wasn't following them. But I think it was more physicality for Koberger. I think that looking in that window, that old way of being creepy, you know, old school creep rather than new school creep online. He was following that, and he's sitting there and he's watching and he's fantasizing every day. And this is how he's consuming that fantasy of his. And then at one point it breaks and he has to go in. He has to do something. But it does make me wonder, was this planned for that night or was this someday when the moment's right, when it strikes, I'm going to strike. And I wonder if this just happened to be the night that he just couldn't hold it back and chose to go in and then is utterly shocked that there's all these other people in there. Or I'm assuming he thought Xana was sleeping. And I don't think he anticipated Kaylee being there. And I think that plays out a bit too in what we've later learned now about the brutality of all of this.
Yeah. And the brutality of it really kind of struck me as well. When we're trying to identify this arc of his, because the one thing I wasn't really seeing until we've seen some deeper dives and some releases is that arc, and Howard alluded to it as well. Mm-hmm. And his arc is the rage arc.
Yeah.
And even though he didn't do anything as violent as this, there was a rage arc, and so here's my conjecture. He went out there with the intention of, I'm going to eventually do this because I want to experience this because of the emotional need and whatever fantasy, you know, whatever he wanted to do to impress people, all that we've talked about. But I think as he's going through and being that teaching assistant, and it's ramping up, that anger and rage is ramping up because he's not being recognized. He's being, you know, turned in for being creepy. He's getting counseled. He's almost being thrown out of the program. It kind of reached that crescendo as he's already stalking this area out because he's identified the house. He's identified people in the house. And then all of a sudden we have this snap moment. He's like, his anger and rage bubbled over. So he then was ready to start executing and this is the execution. That's why the brutality, especially with the first victim, was it 70 stab wounds?
It's high.
That is rage, pure, unadulterated rage. And so that was, it's got to come from somewhere. And that was the escalation. It was a rage escalation, I think, was probably coming from his time as being a teaching assistant and also being lambasted and sucking at that.
Well, and sucking at this too. I mean, literally, yeah. I think he went, my guess is he went in thinking he was going to get to Maddie, and there's going to be an essay and he was going to kill her. Or I don't even know, maybe not even kill, maybe just that and get out and be masked and get away. But he gets confronted by all of these other people. And even the plan he had gets screwed up. And I could, in a really, I can almost like picture it in like a movie type way where he goes in, he thinks he's going to do this. And all of a sudden, you know, just that look he has about him, that blank stare, like, oh my gosh, he's met with reality that wasn't exactly what he thought it was going to be. And he's like, just going nuts, just anybody who's in his way, and they screwed it up. I feel like the excessive rage in this case was more so because even this plan he messed up. And so he just went to town, and I'm not trying to be crass or anything, but he just went crazy on these people because of that rage, because again, he was stopped and his plan went to shit. And why is that? Because these people were there, not because he shouldn't be in this house doing what he's doing, but because they got in his way. There's no other explanation, really.
And from the very beginning, I remember, you know, when we started covering this together 3 years ago, the first thing that that struck me, and it's held true throughout this, is that he planned this as if this was a final in high school, mm-hmm. and he's a student, and he's going to execute this, and his supreme arrogance was his undoing the entire time, because he failed this exam, and he could not, this guy, thankfully, could not innovate.
Yeah.
He could not take something new, take a new data, and as much as he thinks he's so smart and great, as Olivia was saying, he's a horrible student. He's the worst student there possibly is, because he didn't learn a thing outside of the stovepipe of what he thought reality was. And he thought this stovepipe in which he saw the world, mm-hmm. was it, and he's completely right, and everyone else is an idiot.
Yeah.
Which, as tragic as this is, I still think had he been a better student, this would— he would not have made the mistakes, and this might have continued to go on.
Oh, we also learned how sloppy he was as well. There's Tinder messages out there now, and this would have been big as evidence had this gone to court. Connected to Koberger, where allegedly he's mentioning K-bar knives,
yeah,
and dark fantasies of, like, what's the worst way to die? You know, like people talk about on Tinder.
And doing it on that Facebook page as well.
Like, who's— like, what on earth? This is just how screwed up his mind is in terms of, like, oh yeah, go on Tinder. People are looking for that. They're looking to find a partner. They're looking to hook up. They're not looking to chat about K-bar knives and the worst way to die. But Koberger thinks that's going to be the calling card to get some.
You know, here's something I hadn't thought of before, but when you're talking about that on Tinder, it really made me think that. There was a voice some time ago. I actually looked up the stats on this, and it's true. And here's what true. I don't remember the exact numbers, but the number of people and by gender that are into true crime, it's vastly dominant on the female side. Females are definitely much more into true crime stories and stories like this than males definitely are. And I really wonder if part of his motivation was that.
How so?
Maybe trying to, you know, so he's kind of talking on these forums. He's on the Facebook page that was created around mm-hmm. this case and Tinder. And he's on these forums trying to, you know, share his expertise and get these thoughts and opinions. And who's he interacting with for predominantly on these sites?
Women.
Women.
Yeah. Well, because look at his attorney team. I mean, I didn't know that he had a whole lot of choice in that matter, but, he's, I thought it was funny.
I'm on the way out on the conjecture thing on that one, but yeah. it's just since you brought up Tinder on it and what he was posting, it's like, you know, it's the only time I'm thinking about it. It's the only time where he's actually having an interaction with a female that actually might've been halfway interested in the things he was saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because he has this rage for women and he's being represented by all women.
Look happy in the courtroom with him at sentencing.
Oh my God. There was like Ann Koberger used to be, or not Ann Koberger, Ann Taylor.
I always forget her name.
Ann Taylor. She was visibly like, I'm sitting a little bit further away from this guy this time. Like he's not there. It wasn't like it was in the hearings.
No, it almost, you felt, I felt for them.
Yeah.
To a degree.
They did their job, without a doubt.
Shame. It felt like shame was just leaking out of them.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know who the assistant attorney is on the other, on Koberger's left.
Yeah.
But I saw her smirk when Olivia started talking and Steve Gonzalez started talking.
I did, like, too.
There would have just been me trying to see what wasn't there, but I was watching them when they were eviscerating him. And Anne was, again, she kept her head down most of the time.
I thought I got a little nod or two out of Anne when Olivia was letting him have it.
Yeah,
like, especially when they were talking about, like, prison justice. I swear to I could be wrong. I was watching it, you know, in real time. Oh, and I think I saw a little bit of, yeah, please take him off this planet.
Oh, it was really good.
Because, I mean, I can't imagine, like, what's, I mean, I asked Bob Mata this the other day, defense attorney. I said, Bob, what is she thinking right now in that courtroom from a defense attorney standpoint? And he said, I know exactly what she's thinking. I saved my client's life and I did my job.
Right.
And she did. That was her job. She succeeded at doing her job. The question at the end of the day is, okay, yes, but you're a human being too, and you're hearing all of this horror that your client that you so, you know, desperately saved the life of did these horrible things. Do you feel good about yourself? I mean, it's your job. That's why we have defense attorneys. I mean, I'm not against defense attorneys, but you know, I guess that comes with the territory in something like this.
I've never done a deep dive on this, and I'm sorry. When dealing with Ann Taylor, she wasn't court appointed, was she? She was court appointed.
Yep.
Okay.
She was the only one of the, and the issue with it was because there was very few death penalty qualified appointed attorneys.
Remember that.
In the state. And she was one of them. And that's who she got.
Hey, because the only reason I asked, because I was curious, like she did a really good job for court appointed.
Oh, but she's a super good, but I mean, to be a death penalty qualified attorney, you're going to get a good one. You know, it's not a speeding or, you know, a petty crime or something. So you're getting
a hard job for her, huh?
Yeah, you get the best there. But yeah, I mean, I would feel, I don't know. I would think I'd be bathing in Purell for days after all of that, because it was just so, so extreme.
You definitely got to believe in the law more than you believe in people, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's good they're out there. As much as it's like, there's wrong.
Then you have those ones that represented Richard Allen, Delphi.
Exactly. Exactly. You have people that are wrongly convicted. Obviously, that's not the case.
Not the case here. Oh, my gosh.
No. The K-bar knife, obviously, the sheath left behind. We still don't know where the murder weapon is. We don't know exactly how the hell he got in and out of there with as horrible and gruesome as this scene was without, you know, leaving a trail behind him. I mean, I think that's still a bit of a mystery. You know, I don't know how you physically do that. How do you get out of there without leaving a trail of some sort? That to me still kind of defies a lot of logic on this.
I think the greatest thing he did for his planning was that.
Mm-hmm.
I think his OCD behaviors were actually helped him in that sense. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, again, some of the leakage we heard about the car was that it looked like the car had been totally disassembled to get all the blood splatter that could have even been out of there. But yeah, so the one area he did a good job in, and it's only one, was that, you know, to have no DNA whatsoever after he created a disaster zone of blood splatter and DNA all over the place, to have none that could be tied to him. I think that's going to go down as one of the most profound things too, just because, especially with our technology today. I mean, think about it. We were able to get a minor, I think it was a thumbprint, like half of a thumbprint, not a thumbprint itself, but the DNA off a snap of a knife sheath that was under a bloody body, to be able to tie it to the dad to go back to him. Yet they could find not a molecule of any of the victims anywhere on him, his car, his apartment, or anything. That's remarkable.
And you know, they didn't find it. I do wonder if it was there, because there's a couple things I look at in this case and go,
you mean the knife?
Not the knife, just in general. Like, was there more evidence that was missed in the investigation itself? I mean, the house got torn down. I do wonder, because there are elements to this that they've come out and said, well, this is that. One of those specifically being the Papa Roger online persona. Yeah, and they said, no, that was not him. We have concluded that was
not him. They said it wasn't him, really.
They said it wasn't him. I don't believe that.
I don't believe it either.
I don't. Then you didn't look hard enough, I think, is the answer to that question. You didn't look hard enough, because there's no way in hell someone had a online picture that looks just like Brian Koberger releasing information that no one else has knowledge of publicly before. No, it was him. How else would this have happened? How else would you, if it was a different picture, sure, maybe so you could have some nutcase out there just spewing stuff and it just happened to be right. You don't have some nutcase spewing it and having the picture of Koberger.
And so the only, so here's, even when you're looking at these online forums, and there's a lot of noise because there's a lot of people on them that were doing it. The thing in that case too, with the Papa Roger thing, is So people are generally commenting on the same thing. So you're going to get a wave of statements, of theories, and all these things that are waving like this. And then you have only one person that spikes up like this with the things they're saying. Like, you got to pay attention to that one because that one's different. What is making that one person different in the things they're saying? Because there's a spike, because you have a normal behavior of all these other people, but you have one spike. Now, if there's like 3 to 5 to 10 other people saying the same thing, maybe. But one, that's, again, laws of probability. I'm always going on probabilities. So the probability of that actually having been him is higher than it not being him.
I mean, look at this. And
I know, I remember when that photo came out.
And the damn name, Roger. It's a nod to Elliot Roger.
I know.
Of course it's him. And that's when I saw that of, oh, it's not him. Look harder.
Yeah.
So what else did we not look hard enough at, too, is my question. If that you believe is not him. And why do you believe it's not him? What was the thing that brought you to that conclusion? Was it an IP address? Can you definitively tell me who it was then? Or can they definitively say off the record, we know it was this person? I mean, I don't buy that one. I know Coffendaffer posted about it because she was big on it. She was probably the biggest person on it forever. And I'm actually talking to her this afternoon. I'm curious to get her thoughts. But she had tweeted about it saying, okay, it wasn't him. I was wrong. I don't think she was wrong. Again,
let's just look at data.
Yeah.
Let's look at the data points. It was Papa, what the hell's the name again?
Roger.
Papa Roger, from what I understand, he was the only one that came out with these theories about the knife and all these things
And started steering people away when they were talking about the Elantra, things that were like solid of like how to find him. No, that's a red herring. He steered people.
But it's one person. See, when you had a spike. So one person, I have a hard time steering away from one person. So here's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm in law enforcement and I got a spike like that. That's where we focus all resources and guns on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And you flush that out until you are 100% convinced that that's not the person. And you can then explain it, you know, with whether it's in the moment where, you know, at the time or in the documents that we should be getting now. So with the gag order lifted, one thing they should be able to do, if it was indeed not him, is show you exactly what they did to say it wasn't him.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to name the name of who it is, obviously, but why? It's not just it wasn't him. Why? How was that not him? Because I have very little faith in other cases that you're not going to be able to recognize people like this if you're thinking that this is not him.
And so if it's not him, how come the person that actually is, with all the notoriety they could have for being so spot on, how come they haven't come forward?
Exactly. Well, and this too. I mean, the man was obsessed with being other people because he was such a shitty human being himself. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, he... Yeah. American Psycho, we called that right away with the picture of him, this one with the shower. It's in the shower. I mean, it was a breadcrumb.
It's also a self-made trophy.
It is. And it was him trying to be elusive. I mean, he didn't know the picture was ever going to get out. That was for him to look at and go, ha, ha, ha. But if anyone ever did find it, yes, it's a nod to Psycho. It's a nod to American Psycho with the getup. It's a nod to Norman Bates. It's a nod to the thumbs up Bundy. I mean, it's all this. And yes, and there's Papa fucking Roger. So it's him. I mean, this was his propensity to do this. And he probably still will do this from behind bars. There's going to be more of him trying to emulate other people. I think he's going to go down BTK's road a bit and really try to communicate and have some sort of dialogue with people.
I think part of what I think, one of the reasons he took that plea deal is because he saw he could be another BTK from behind bars.
Exactly.
The problem is, BTK is a lot smarter, he's a lot smoother, and he's a lot more congenial.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, literally, he, as horrendous as BTK is, he's a more likable guy than Koberger.
Yep.
And you know, and so Koberger's, so what I envision Koberger trying to do is BTK-like things, mm-hmm. and he's going to fumble the ball.
And that's the thing with this, too. And that's a good point. this kid has always fumbled the ball on everything he has. So what is there to study about Brian Koberger at the end of the day? Honest to God. I mean, I get
it's like Olivia said, he's nothing but a wannabe.
He is. Because, look, BTK is worth studying. There's a long history of his shit that he terrorized Wichita for, like, decades. Ted Bundy's worth studying. All these people who had a lot of reps, who got away with it over and over and over again and manipulated people over and over again, they are worth studying. Koberger didn't manipulate anybody. Koberger was an idiot.
Oh, my God. It just struck me because all these other people, like BTK, Ted Bundy, all that, they were original.
Yes. He's not.
Koberger's a mimic.
Like, other than studying him as a mimic, there's nothing to study here. He wasn't good at what he did.
Right.
He wasn't.
He sucked at being everyone else.
Yes. He sucked at being himself, and he sucked at being everyone else. Yeah. And it's because of the way his mind works. I just don't know what there is to study here. And I'm glad there are people like Catherine Ramsland out there who I'm sure will hopefully, you know, get to do a little insight on this.
And I hope they take the judge's lead on it. Yeah. Who says, hey, study him, but don't release it. You know, use it in academic circles and things like that, but give him no notoriety.
It's going to be out there. It'll be a book. We know that's going to happen. But I just don't know that there's any depth here. It was a very perplexing case to watch. It was outrageous of what he did, but he ain't no Ted Bundy. He's not BTK. He's a student. He got away with it for a short period of time, like less than a month, and then he left a ton of evidence.
Failed wannabe.
Yeah, I mean, because it wasn't just the, the knife sheath and the DNA as being the linchpin. We're learning now. There's a lot of other stuff that they were going to bring out.
The car had him nailed really good.
Yeah.
The cell phone data. Yeah. had him nailed really good. I mean, because again, he operated in such a stovepipe for someone that we're theorizing was planning on murdering people for such a long time. And we've said this before. People shouldn't. You know, what they're failing at is they're planning the murder and how to cover their tracks of the murder. They're not learning how to cover their tracks of the planning of the murder.
No. He's not this elusive enigma that I think.
He's not smart.
No, he's not. He's blinders completely. And that's what is his biggest downfall is.
He had dumb luck about cleaning up his mess of blood.
Mm-hmm. He was good at that. His OCD served him well there. And that's the only thing he did good. Yeah.
He screwed up throwing his trash away. He screwed up.
His alibi.
It was funny. Even the Facebook page, reading James Patterson's book about them kind of poking at who leaves a knife sheath behind? Who doesn't have it at least on their belt? I mean, how, like, would you carry a knife in the knife sheath? I mean, what the hell is it not doing on your belt? What?
Like, why is the sheath off of you?
Why is it off there?
Yeah.
And then Papa George's or Giorgio.
Papa Giorgio is Vegas vacation.
I know.
Papa Giorgio.
Papa Giorgio's response was that, well, you're going to walk in there with a knife unsheathed? He was so stupid, he wasn't even getting the point.
No.
Moron.
Jail records, this has been interesting to learn about what's been going on behind bars. Reporting he's obsessively washing his hands dozens of times a day, taking extended 45-minute showers. I didn't know you could take extended 45-minute showers in prison. Like,
hey, you might not want to do that after a while.
It might not be a good thing. I think it'd be like, get in, get out. But he's doing that. There's also reports that he has a very bizarre sleeping schedule, more reminiscent of Dracula than a human being, sleeping during the day, staying up at night, all night, and it's disturbing to the other inmates because it's like, what the hell is this guy doing? Obviously, and also asking to speak to a priest immediately after being arrested. With some of these new things that we're learning about his behavior behind bars, what do you make of it as a behavioral expert?
I still think it's just a case of real broken brain.
Yeah.
And broken brain comes, you know, it's not just in him killing four kids. You know, it was broken in a lot of different ways. I think sleep schedules, his whole, I mean, just think about this. The thing that causes people to do things is massive chemical imbalances, and chemical imbalances in the brain are going to manifest in a lot of other areas, whether mm-hmm. it's sleep, melatonin production, and then seeing a priest. Remember, so the first thing that I thought of when you said see a priest is he's still seeking and needs stimulation of some sort, because that's the whole reason, I think, part of the reason why he wanted to kill someone is kind of get the stimulation that he wasn't getting. He was getting no, he gets no emotional stimulation. He told his father about that early growing up. And so I think he's doing his best to try to keep doing something to trigger some sort of emotional response someplace in his brain. And maybe seeing a priest was going to be his way of doing it. It definitely ain't for repentant, because he doesn't give a rat's ass about that.
No, I'm like, how does religiousness play any role in his, unless it's a twisted brain? It very well could. He could.
Yeah, but also, you know, Rex Heuermann saw a priest too.
Yeah.
So, ugh.
I mean, it's self-serving. It's someone being able to tell you what you did is okay. And, yeah. And you'll get forgiven for that.
So think about this. So what do priests do when they see you? They listen and validate you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's his mother doing?
Yep.
There you go. So when he can't talk to his mommy, he's going to talk to a priest.
The only
Not because
people,
he's religious, yeah. But, yeah. But maybe someone will sit there and listen to him rant about how he is.
I'd like to pay a priest to go tell him he's going to burn in hell. Like, have the priest go and just like Olivia Gonzalez. Like, I want it to be like that, where he thinks he's going to get a nice little like church time, and it's like the church lady like on crack. Bring Martin Short in there as the church lady. Like, you're going to hell.
Yeah, you know, it's sad we're laughing about it, but yeah. I think he just that. It's because of the Consalvises. They really did a good job of helping us all deal with this. They really yeah. did, because they helped all of us go on offense with him in a yeah. much more profound way than I ever thought anyone could ever do that.
I've never,
because look what yeah. we're doing. We're yeah. laughing at him.
We are. I mean, and there you had. Yeah, I mean, it's so pathetic once you look, and once we're learning more and more about all this too. It's like, holy shit.
So think about how awesome this is and how those Consalvis family did this. Had we only listened to the heart-wrenching, amazing, profound stories of the impact of the survivors, of the other roommates and all the family members, we'd be sitting here most likely talking about them, the people that were lost, the impact, and what a horrible human being he is. Meanwhile, we're riffing off of what the Consalvises gave us about what a pathetic human being he is. Yeah. And so it's enabled people like you and me and the rest of the world to poke fun at the piece of crap of a mm-hmm. human being that he is. And he's going to get nothing but that yeah. for the rest of his life. Good.
Yeah. I hope you found us on your iPad, Brian.
Yes. Wouldn't that be great? You suck.
Your time's coming. There's a lot of people that want to, you know, fill
the
their canteen.
Big D's coming for you.
The Big D is on the way, bro.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers Podcast.